Blog Talk Radio.
Fans, welcome to the show here on another Sunday afternoon. 2T and Sign Guy with you as normal. Our guest should be arriving very shortly. 2T, what a huge day yesterday. Top 9 and 7/8 wrestler rankings came out on the Facebook of Beast Barnett and episode 431 of The Sign of the Times.
Making 431 episode will prove pivotal in our Turnbuckle Turmoil Sign of the Times history. Yes, because it was the first time a Turnbuckle Turmoil Sign of the Times was shot on a military base.
I believe you're actually right. I don't recall any other shot on a military base. And I believe it was the first time I had both my Tracy Smother shirt and book at the same time.
Oh, okay.
And it looks like our guest has joined us, so I'm going to bring him right away. We are extremely pleased to have with us today, Reno Riggins. Sir, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
Absolutely our pleasure. And since it is your first time on Turnbuckle Turmoil today, we are going to start you off with our traditional first-timer question. What led to you getting into the pro wrestling industry?
Oh, man. I was at the University of Tennessee, and I was going to play football there. And I'd had a preferred walk-on opportunity there. I'd passed up some opportunities to play at a couple of other schools because my lifelong dream was to play at the University of Tennessee. And so I get there, and I realized pretty quick I'm not going to be an NFL player. I'm not 6'5" and run like a gazelle. But I was going to hold blocking dummies for about 4 years, I guess. And so and play special teams. So I thought, you know what? I think my football days are over with, but I wanted to do something different. And we were sitting around a dorm one day, and one of my buddies saw a magazine that said one of the highest paid professional athletes in the country was Hulk Hogan. And he told me, he says, you know what? He says, I think you could do this. And I didn't even bat an eye. I packed up school the next day and left, come back home and broke the news to my parents that I was leaving college to pursue a career in professional wrestling. And they both about had a duck. And they said, we had actually planned for you to be a dentist. And but if this is what you want to do, then we'll support you. So I came back home and met a, it took me about 6 months to finally get accepted by a guy who is training professional wrestlers here in Nashville, Tennessee, is where my hometown is. And the guy's name was Tojo Yamamoto. And a lot of the folks that are wrestling enthusiasts now, they don't really know who Tojo was or understand the impact that he had on the wrestling business at that time. But he was a major player. He was a former a big wrestling star of the 60s and 70s here in the South. And man, he took me on and trained me to pursue my career as a professional wrestler. And one of the other students that was in the class at the same time was Sid Vicious. So Sid Vicious and I trained together.
One other very famous wrestler that came out of the University of Tennessee was a University of Tennessee volunteer basketball player. I know you came across him quite a bit in your career. Did you ever sit down and talk about the volunteers with Kevin Nash?
Oh, yeah. I knew Kevin had played there. I played basketball there for Coach Don DeVoe. And so, you know, both of our blood runs orange. Although, I think Kevin had left school early. Or him and the coach maybe didn't necessarily see eye to eye. And maybe that was the reason why his NBA career was cut short due to him pursuing other opportunities as well. And there was also another Tennessee Vol, a guy named Doug Furness. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Doug Furness or not, but he was
absolutely.
Okay. So yeah, all of them great guys too.
Now you have had the pleasure of working pretty much all around the world in your wrestling career. I know that in today's climate of things, the WWE has taken a lot of criticism for doing shows in Saudi Arabia. They make quite a bit of money with the deal that they had struck with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia before politics creeped into that. Did you ever get to wrestle in that region of the world, and did you have an opinion on wrestling over there?
Yeah. I believe it was in 99 or 2000. I wrestled in Saudi Arabia. I wrestled in Kuwait, Bahrain. Had a great time at all three of those, and actually it was – when I went, it was for a company out of, I believe, North Carolina, World Wrestling Association, I think it was. A guy by the name of Slim Balk owned the company, and he put together a real good tour, and it was basically a USO tour, and we went to military bases, U.S. military bases, in those parts of the world. Camp Doha was one of them, And they had put actually a pretty entertaining card together. The Rock and Roll Express was on the card. The Bushwhackers was on the card. Who else? Jackie Fulton. Maybe Tommy Rogers may have been on one of those cards. A guy named Ricky Nelson, I think, out of North Carolina. Chuck Coates. Who else was on there? Sergeant Craig Pittman. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him from, like, in the 90s. He worked at WCW for a bit. So it was a pretty entertaining card. Jimmy Golden from over at East Tennessee, he was there. Great guy as well. It was a great tour. But wrestling over in that part of the country, of course, all that was, you know, before 9/11. And I'm just bebopping through the world, just seeing how other people live and what their culture is and what their beliefs are. And, but also, one of the most gratifying things that I'd ever done was go over there and wrestle for our troops, you know, doing a USO tour. They paid us quite handsomely, but to be honest with you, when I got back from the experience, I'd have probably done it for free if they had asked me again, because it was so enriching to see those young men and women that serve our country on a daily basis. And, you know, a lot of folks here in our country, I believe, take that for granted, that they're on vacation. They're over there protecting us, and they're over there planted in certain parts of the world for our benefit. So, I mean, I had a great time there, had an enriching experience. Got to see how different people in the world live and how they conduct their daily lives. And to me, it was a great experience. So, and as far as the political situation that goes on today and WWE going to those places, I'm not too in tune with what happens these days with any of that, so I probably wouldn't be the best person to maybe seek an opinion on that.
You, like I said, wrestled in a whole lot of places in your career. One of the places is very fondly remembered by a lot of fans, and they're having a reunion show hopefully within the next couple of months, and that being the Global Wrestling Federation, which was on ESPN in the early 90s. Do you have a lot of memories working for the GWF when they were wrestling 5 days a week on ESPN?
Oh yeah, that was a good time. That was that company. I mean, at the time, you know, you kind of started seeing your globalization and domination of WWF and WCW, and all your smaller promotions were kind of drying up at that time. And then when Global kind of came on the scene, it was an opportunity for guys like myself or guys that had been around and couldn't get hired by the WWF or WCW to go and show their wares and work on their craft. And I was called, I myself, Barry Horowitz, was called to come down and work, you know. And so we were thankful for the opportunity. At the time, I wasn't under contract with WWF, so I was a free agent. So, you know, anybody who's ringing the phone, that's who I go work for that day, right? And that was the situation there. And I got to go down. That's where I first met Sean Waltman, 123 Kid, X-Pac. That's where I first met him. And I knew pretty early on he had some talent. And I thought, this kid, you're going to be hearing his name here in a few. He was Lightning Kid there. That's what it was. And I thought, you know, this kid, you know, if given a break, given an opportunity, he might be able to do something. And then I think Bagwell was there. He was just, you know, kind of getting his feet up under him. And I worked with some great, you know, veterans that was there. Eddie Gilbert, who I'd worked against in Memphis a few times. And then, gorgeous Gary Young. I worked with Gary Young a few times there. And who else? The guy from Missouri. I don't know. Jeff Gaylord. Yeah, Jeff Gaylord was there. So it was it was an eclectic group of wrestlers, different styles of wrestling, and I mean, I actually enjoyed it. It was a good time. I think maybe I did maybe a handful of events for them, not a whole lot, but it was still nice to add that to my resume and be able to do that.
Now, one of the things that you also did a lot of in your career was tag team wrestling. You had many, many partners throughout your career. Tag team wrestling is often a very different animal compared to singles wrestling. Whenever you were part of a tag team, did you have to have a different type of mindset going into the matches, or was it more or less the same for you as a singles match would have been?
No, it's a totally different game. Whenever you're in a tag match, I mean, it's four times the drama, because you have, you know, four participants in a tag team match, and a lot of different things can happen, good and bad, in a tag team match. But as a kid growing up watching wrestling, I always enjoyed the tag team wrestling more so than I did singles matches, just due to the fact that I felt that there was more jeopardy in the match and possibilities of who was going to possibly be victorious. And some of the teams that I grew up admiring, you know, and I don't want to age those guys, but at this point, hey, we're all old, so I don't think they'll mind, but was Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, because I grew up here in Nashville, Tennessee. And I used to watch Jarrett Promotions, which at the time I think was CWA, Championship Wrestling Association. And they, you know, I mean, tag team wrestling was big. And you would always you know, see a tremendous amount of different teams. And one of the hottest teams that they had here for a long time was Steve Lane and Stan Kearns, which are the Fabulous Ones. And they had some memorable battles with the Road Warriors here in Nashville at the Fairgrounds Sports Arena. That as a kid, my uncle would take me down there, and I would go, you know, get to go see my heroes, you know, live and in Technicolor. I mean, it was live action heroes right there in front of you. So tag team wrestling was always, always, you know, my first love. And when I first, you know, started wrestling for the bigger organizations, at the time you're just doing television matches, so they just basically pair you off with whoever's there. And I've teamed up with Jimmy Powers. I've teamed up with Stephen Dunn, Barry Horowitz, Lanny Poffo, Brooklyn Brawler, through the Dusty Wolf, you know, Brian Costello, some guys that are, you know, from the way back when. And but the most success that I had as a being in a tag was with Stephen Dunn, who used to be with Well Done back in the early or back in the mid 90s at WWF, and he and I formed a team in the late 90s, and we had a pretty good run in the NWA. I think we were like six-time NWA North American Tag Champs and the NWA World Champs at one point. So and actually talking about the Middle East, we won the belts from the Rock and Roll Express in Saudi Arabia. So kind of get two birds with one stone with that answer. But yeah, tag team wrestling, a whole lot of different combinations of what could go wrong or go right, or, you know, who could possibly win. A lot of different things you could do in the finish to really spice things up. So, and of course, you know, living here in Nashville and watching wrestling coming out of Memphis with Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, and seeing the Sheepherders and the Fabulous Ones, Rock and Roll Express, all those combinations back then, I felt, you know, put a pretty good firm foundation in my mind of what a tag partner or a tag team, you know, should try to accomplish when they're out there entertaining the fans. So I always love tag team wrestling.
We have a game on the show we like to play. We call it Word Association, where I'll throw out the names of some guys that you likely have come across in your career, and the first word or two that pops to mind is the answer. Are you prepared for a round of Word Association?
I'm prepared.
All right,
yeah,
here
yeah,
we
I'm
go.
Ready. Just shoot them at me.
Mr. Fuji.
Mr. Fuji, funny. Loved Mr. Fuji. He was very entertaining, good to travel with. But I remember him just as funny, a great sense of humor, and always a pleasure to be around.
Tracy Smothers.
Tracy Smothers, another guy that I've been up and down the road with. A great heart. The reason I say Tracy Smothers has a great heart, I was working in Smoky Mountain Wrestling for Jim Cornette, and I was a young undercard babyface, and they came to me and Tracy said, "Hey, look, we want you guys to go 12, 15 minutes, you know, babyface match for television." And oh my God, that's you know, even back in the day, sometimes people would cringe, say, "Oh, that's too hard to do in a house show. No one gets behind the babyface match, you know, babyface versus babyface." But we went out there and on television, and I felt like we had a barn burner. And then afterwards, he gave me probably one of the best live, you know, interviewed promotions that another. I mean, he verbally put me over to the fans, and I believe it was sincere. It just wasn't him just spewing out stuff, what he'd been told or a writer had written it for him. It was coming from the heart. So Tracy Smothers has a big heart, and he'll always have a special place in my heart, and a great wrestler.
Flash Flanagan.
Flash Flanagan. probably one of the most underrated wrestlers. I'd say underrated. And why I say that is, you know, I've pretty much wrestled the Mount Rushmore of professional wrestlers, you know, through my career. I've wrestled the Bret Hart, the Shawn Michaels, the Ric Flairs, you name it, and you say, hey, that guy's one of the best ever. I've wrestled them. And Flash Flanagan, in my book, is in that conversation. Unfortunately, you know, like so many other great guys in this industry, it's sometimes just being at the right place at the right time. There's guys that have gotten tremendous in this building, I mean, in this business, and can't carry his boots across the ring. It's just, you know, getting a big break doesn't always mean that you have talent, and especially in this business. And Flash Flanagan, one of the most underrated guys in the history of this business.
Sweet Stan Lane.
Sweet Stan Lane. Super nice guy. Stan Lane, nice guy, great wrestler. I probably wrestled him over 100 times when he was with him and Steve Kearns as the Fabulous Ones, or when he was with Bobby Eaton in the Midnight Express. I've always took a sense of pride when I started working at WCW that Stan would come and find me, and he'd say, who they got you on the card with? Have they got you booked with anybody yet? Because back then, we would do like 3 hours of TV. You know, three shows of television tapings in one night. And so, you know, an undercard guy like myself at the time, I might wrestle two or three times that night, you know. So he would say, have they got your booked with anybody yet? And of course, it was very early, so, you know, the matches hadn't been put together yet. So he would always make it a point to go tell Jimmy, you know, Jim Cornette, hey, go get Reno booked with me and Bobby Eaton so we can, you know, have a decent match, not get hurt, fight another day, you know. So super nice guy and always took care of me in the ring, and which I always try to reciprocate, and I miss him. He's a good guy. I hadn't talked to him in years, but he's a good one.
Rickhouse Brown.
Rickhouse Brown. Love me some Rickhouse. Love me some Rickhouse Brown. Had always had really good matches with Rickhouse. He and I, you know, even when I would run shows in the Middle Tennessee area, I would always make it a point to try to have Brick on the card because I knew he would show up. He always looked like $1 million, and he's the only guy I think ever that always looked like $1 million but never went to the gym. Would always give me his best. I always thought I had a pretty good mind for the business, and did things that made sense, and always a pleasure. But I'd say him, a $1 million body and never had to go to the gym.
Luna Vachon.
Luna Vachon. Oh, my goodness. Where do I start with Luna? She was at WWF. I met her when I was at WWF. She had was in the role of a manager, and met her on the road a few times through and doing TVs and, you know, just socializing. And once again, another one that was always just a sweetheart, and do whatever, you know, if you ever asked her of anything, she was always there to help. So I'm trying to think of a good description, though, because I don't think one word can give her a fitting title. Explosive in a good way. Always put a smile on my face. And always, if I was in maybe a foul mood, she always could change it and put me in a good one. So I'm going to say explosive.
Barry Horowitz.
Barry. Let's see here. Barry Horowitz. Barry Horowitz is the ultimate travel partner. And when I say that, Barry and I traveled together for about 5 years. And I never was late for a show. I never missed a flight. Always had the best deals on the hotels, rental cars, the best restaurants for the cheapest prices when we would travel in and out of town. Never paid for a gym, because back then, you know, we might be in town for that one day. He always knew where to go work out at. Always got the free T-shirt at the gym back in those days. And consummate professional. He's another guy who's very underrated. And still to this day, we're friends. We usually touch base with each other once a week when we can. If we don't connect, we always leave each other a voice message. And actually, I got to see Barry back last fall. We did a convention together up in Philadelphia and New Jersey. And it was the first time that we had seen each other in about 25 years, physically being him in the same place. So it was great to get to see him and catch up with him. And he lives down in the Tampa area. Of course, I'm here in Nashville. So every day he calls me, he tells me it's a nice sunny 85, and he's laying out in his backyard getting a tan. So there's a great guy. He's a travel professional.
James Beard.
I think I only met James Beard maybe a handful of times when I was down at Global wrestling down there. Like I said, you know, super guy from what I could tell in the short amount of time that I got to spend with him. And I'd really like to spend some time with him because I know he has a plethora of wrestling stories I'd like to pick his brain about. So he's from my short time that I got to visit with him, great guy.
Zeus.
Who?
Zeus from the WWF.
Zeus, never met him. Never met him.
All right.
I was on a few shows with him, but never, our paths never crossed, not even in the locker room.
Tatanka.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he was... He gives a great job. One of my when they first started doing Monday Night Raw, I think they had done maybe a handful of episodes to this point, and we were shooting it live at the Manhattan Center there in New York, and I was slated to work with him one night, and at the time, I was dating my wife. She was going to college at Middle Tennessee State University, but she didn't know I was a professional wrestler. And I didn't. If while I'm away from the business, I don't. Hey, look at me, I'm a wrestler. You know, I never did that. I had a switch. When I pulled up to the building, I flipped the switch and the show started. And then when I pulled out of the arena, hey, flipped the switch and I'm back to being me. And so my wife, my girlfriend at the time, she didn't know I was a professional wrestler. And so I finally kind of liked her, and I was kind of getting more serious with her. And so I thought, well, you know what, I might need to tell her what I do for a living here. So I called her up, and I said, hey, are you, do you have USA Cable Network at your dorm room? She goes, yeah. I says, well, turn it on. And I says, in about 20 minutes, look on there and see if you see anybody that you know. And I said, I'll call you back in about an hour. So sure enough, I go out that night, and I'm wrestling Tatanka. And so that was the first time she'd ever seen me as a wrestler on a Monday Night Raw. So I'm wrestling Tatanka that night, and me and him had been on a loop together where we were pretty familiar with each other's styles. So I knew we could have a really good match, a good television match. And so we went out there and we did. We're having a good match, and I was the heel. So finally, I cut him off, and anyway, he stops and he's got my arm, and the handheld camera's right there at ringside, and I look at the camera, and I look right into the camera, and my wife's name is Tracy, and I said, Tracy, he's breaking my arm as I'm selling it, you know, because I would always do silly stuff like that with
friends of mine that I went to high school with years ago that knew I wrestled, so who might call me up, hey, my kid loves wrestling, can you say something? So I would always try to do those types of things hidden in the match somewhere, you know. And then, of course, I was, you know, always trying to get as much air time as I possibly could, so the camera comes back around, and I've got to talk in the corner, and I'm punching him and kicking him and choking him, and the camera's right there, so I felt like I needed to say something. So I looked at the camera and I yelled, I've got no reservations about beating up an Indian. You know, now, of course, today, you know, I would get yanked off the air or Vince and then would get, you know, sued or somebody would be upset. But back then, you know, our job was to evoke emotions, whether good, bad, or indifferent. And so the wrestling business to me has really, really changed because I don't think you can do those types of things anymore. But as far as Tatanka goes, oh, just a great guy. Always enjoyed working with him, having matches. He's heavy to pick up for a body slam. I'd have a better chance picking up a semi-truck. Oh, my goodness, he's heavy. But great guy. Love him.
The final name, Rip Rogers.
Rip Rogers. Okay. So... I got two good Rip Rogers stories. So I'm a young greenhorn, and Tojo Yamamoto is helping me get booked on a lot of these different shows and whatnot. And every year, Rip would do a fundraiser for the athletic department at his old high school there in Seymour, Indiana. So, and actually, a lot of people don't know this about Rip. Rip was a really good basketball player. I don't know if that's hidden knowledge or what, but I believe he played for the team that the Harlem Globetrotters would beat, you know, every night in and night out. I think they were the Washington Generals or something like that. And Rip played, I think, a season for the team that would always play the Globetrotters. At least that's what he told me. So we go there to Seymour, Indiana, and we wrestle. I wrestled Tojo that night. And then at the end of the matches, we were all invited over to Rip's house. His wife at the time, Brenda, would always make a big spread and give the boys their payoffs. You know, they're at the house and little, you know, socialize for a little bit. Then everybody hits the road. So here I am. You know, I'm a young starving wrestler, and so I said, you know, I asked Tojo, I said, free food? He says, yeah. So here I am making me this big giant roast beef sandwich, right? And I'm eating this roast beef sandwich, and I'm inhaling the thing, right? Well, about that time, I get choked, and I'm sitting there just all of a sudden realize I can't breathe. I'm basically choking myself out in Rip's living room, right? So I look over at Tojo, and I go, I'm motioning to him to my mouth that I can't breathe, that I'm choking. He looks at me, and he goes, what do you want me to do about it? So then I started panicking, right, because I felt like I was getting ready to just pass out. Fortunately, Rip Rogers' dad comes in, gives me the Heimlich maneuver, and saved my life. So I've always, you know, Rip has always had a real special place in my heart because if it wasn't for his dad, you and I wouldn't be talking today. So I met Rip on a couple of other events, and we'd wrestled down at WCW, I think, and had a pretty good match. And Rip... got asked, I think, by either Jody Hamilton or Bob Roop if we wanted to be a dark match on Halloween Havoc 1990 at Chicago's UIC Pavilion. And so, you know, Rip, he goes, you know, he gets the booking, and he comes to me and he says, hey, do you want to work me at Halloween Havoc? Well, here I am, a young guy. I'd never done a pay-per-view at that point in my career. Who wouldn't, right? So I said, sure. So I drive from Nashville to Seymour, pick him up, and we're driving to Chicago to do the Halloween Havoc. So I get there, and, you know, I'm just chilling and figuring we're going to be first or second match. And I was comfortable working with Rip. We and I had worked together a few times. And I thought, man, we'll go out and we'll have a really good match and, you know, get the crowd, you know, fired up, set a good tone for the night. And so So Rip goes to Bob Roop. Bob Roop was calling the finishes on the undercard that night. And he goes, okay, Bob. He goes, what do you want me to pin Reno with? And he goes, Reno, can you do a flying press from the top? He goes, can you do a flying body cross from the top? I said, sure. He says, okay, Rip, how about this? Reno comes off the top with a flying body press. You catch him 1, 2, 3. All the air just went right out of Rip's sails right there. So Bob walks off, and Rip goes, golly, I can't believe this. I get this guy booked, and they want me to put him over. That's what we did. He ribbed me about that. He complained about that all the way back from Chicago when I dropped him off at Seymour. Then every time I saw him after that for a while. Then I think I saw him in Smoky Mountain Wrestling a few years later. He was still complaining about it. Great guy. Thankful for his dad. And thankful for the matches he and I had together. So, yeah, Rip Rogers is a great guy. Weird. You know, sometimes kind of weird, though. Different. But a pretty highly intelligent, functioning human being. Good guy.
Well, at this time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I know QT has questions for you also, so I'm going to pass things along to him.
All right, throw it on.
Well, thank you, Sign Guy. Hello, Reno.
Hey, how you doing?
Not too bad. Reno, I saw your YouTube video entitled Brian Christopher versus Reno Riggins, 1992, and you had just captured the Southern Heavyweight title. Do you recall this match? I'm sure it's one of many that you had with Brian Christopher.
Yeah, Brian and I, like I said, back in 92, Brian and I tell you, I always felt that we had good chemistry in the ring together. Brian was always wanting to work really, really hard. He went out there every night, and his goal, along with my goal, was to be the best match on the card. You know, sometimes we may have fell short of that, but that was our goal. And if we got out there and felt like we fell short of that goal, we did our best to get it corrected, you know, by the next night. So, you know, they had brought me in, and Brian, I think, was the champion at the time, and that was what I was there for. I was there coming in to challenge Brian Christopher for the belt, and he and I was going to you know, have a run back and forth for a while. And we did. Good interviews. Jerry Lawler was booking it at the time. You know, I owe a lot to Jerry Lawler for, you know, taking a chance on me and letting me have that opportunity to kind of, you know, let me learn the business even a little bit more. I mean, if anybody ever says that they know everything that there is to know, I doubt even Ric Flair would say that because you never – that's what's so intriguing about this business, that you never learn it all. There's always something around the corner that you can pick up to improve your craft. And when you stop looking around the corner to improve your craft, then it's time to move on. And Brian and I, we challenged each other every – Jonesville,
well,
Arkansas, in front of 35 people, or if we were, you know, selling, you know, a big crowd at the Mid-South Coliseum. So, yeah, I mean, it was always an interesting night.
In this particular video, I know it's one of many. If you freeze the video at the 14-second mark, viewers can see, I saw what I originally thought was two playing cards on your boots. I thought one was the Ace of Spades, but really they are two dice. One is a five and one is a two. My question is, do you play a lot of dice in Vegas?
I used to. Actually, I'd go out to Vegas quite a bit. And have a good time, get invited out. Of course, Vegas has changed as well. It's a corporate business.
But back then when it was ran like a casino and you had casino hosts and you didn't have to, you know, go in and drop, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to get invited back, it was a good place to be, you know. But nowadays, you gotta put a lot more on the line than what it was back then. I always enjoyed going to the Stardust. That was my place to play of choice back in the day. Of course, it's gone. But and that's kind of where I kind of came up with the whole Reno Riggins from Las Vegas, Nevada thing. I was kind of struggling, you know, to find an identity that kind of fit me and my personality and what I enjoyed and what I wanted to do at that time. And Tojo Yamamoto told me, he said when I was first, he goes, why don't we call you Jim Riggins? And I thought, man, that's about as bland as you can get. He said, you look like the running back for the Washington Redskins, John Riggins. And there may have been a little bit of similarity there, but maybe not that much, you know. And I was like, well, you know, and Tojo, he was my teacher, he was my sensei, he was, you know, so I trust. And so, you know, I did that for about maybe a year, and then I'd actually had a quick run to in Memphis. Dutch Mantel was booking. And he brought me in. He goes, let's change that name Jim to Axel. We'll call you Axel Riggins. And I was like, oh, I don't know about that either. Just didn't really have a ring. Because I'd always kind of thought that if you looked at guys that had a name that you could remember, you know, of course, Hulk Hogan, H-H, Rick Rude, R-R. You know, usually if the first name and the last name started, you know, with the same letter, It kind of rolled off your tongue. And so I thought, this, that, and the other. And I said, I can't be Las Vegas Riggins. I said, what about Reno Riggins? And I liked it, and I played around with it for a little bit, and then it just kind of stuck. And I'm glad it did. You know, it was fun.
Oh, all right. Well, in that video, you were in a tournament, and you had just won the belt. And you said into the microphone, I wasn't sure how the fans would accept me, and I wasn't sure how I would accept the fans. But you went through quite a few people in that tournament to reach Brian Christopher. Do you recall some of the wrestlers you beat to reach Brian Christopher?
To be honest, I don't. Maybe Mike Miller. I think he was in the territory at the time. And Billy Travis was in the territory at the time. I'm not for certain if I'd beat Billy to move on in this tournament or not. Maybe Doug Gilbert was in it as well. But maybe Mike Miller. Maybe I beat him. But I can't remember. I just can't recall. It's been so many years ago. But I do remember saying that. And I remember, you know, and I think I remember, well, go ahead and I'll keep filling in the blanks here. I'll at least try to.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Reno, do you recall who was the football coach at the University of Tennessee at the time that you were going there?
Johnny Majors.
Oh, okay. Johnny Majors.
Yeah,
okay.
He just passed away. He just passed away a few days ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, do you recall the name of the dorm you were in when your friend said you might think about a career in wrestling? What was it? What was the name of the dorm?
Carrick Hall.
Oh, okay. Is Carrick Hall still there?
That I don't know. It's been a while since I've been to the camp. Actually, I went to the campus about 3 years ago. One of my good friends, and he was one of my best, he was my groomsman. In my wedding, we went to high school together. He was the offensive line coach there about 3 years ago, and now he's moved on. We got him Walter Wells. He's moved on. He's the head football coach at Eastern Kentucky now. But he took me and my kids and my wife on a tour of all the athletic facilities. We was there passing through town one night, and we stopped to visit him, and he was so gracious to give us the kind of the behind-the-scenes tour of the whole
whole shebang. It's a whole lot different now than what it was back then, I'll tell you that. It's big business. I mean, they have everything possible for a young athlete to be successful if they put the time and effort into it.
Yeah, they didn't have the internet back then when you were going.
No, they didn't.
Okay.
No, they didn't.
Okay. Well, Reno, in that particular video with Brian Christopher, if you freeze the wrestling video, I think it's like at the 2-minute mark, you can see that you're wearing red boots with two dice on the side. Do you still have these boots? Or how many pairs of boots did you go through?
That was an orange set. On TV, it might look red, but that was an orange set. And I don't believe I still have those boots.
Oh, okay. Because I saw a YouTube video of you where you wrestled Owen Hart on September 22nd, 1993, and you had a pair of white boots on. White boots.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
But
I
would keep them in inventory for a while. I really kept all my gear until I think it was one of my last tours, and I was in Japan. And when I was in Japan, I knew I was kind of at the end of my rope, end of my run. And I was looking to move on from wrestling at that point. And I was leaving Tokyo. I was flying home, and I left. I took all my wrestling gear, set it by the trash can, got on the plane empty-handed, and said, I'm done. And never looked back.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, Reno, I wanted to talk to you about that. The wrestling crowds in Tennessee, especially in the 90s, could be very rowdy and outspoken and loyal to a fault to their favorite wrestlers. They would sometimes even have weapons. My question is, how did that ever differ from the crowds in Japan?
Japan, the crowds in Japan are a bit more subdued. They watch the matches as if they're watching opera, or if they're watching ballet. And then if something really, you know, moved them, they would kind of give the old golf clap. In Tennessee, you're hearing, you dirty MF-er, I'm going to cut your, you know, I mean, it's daylight and dark. One feels like you're going to a fine restaurant, and the other one feels like you're going to a greasy spoon. But both are very good. Both are – they're just different. They're both good, and, you know, as a wrestling fan, there's some things that wrestlers do that they like to a wrestler for a particular reason. And same thing as a wrestler. You wrestle in certain areas – and sometimes the crowd is super hot and you're really going to be driven to really perform at a super high level. And sometimes they're just flat as a pancake and you're, you know, digging deep to figure out what you got to do to move these people emotionally. And so it's a challenge, you know, sometimes, Hey, we're going to Philly. That's always a hot crowd. Or, hey, we're going to, you know, Memphis. You know, it's usually a really hot crowd, or, you know, then there's some places that you're scratching your head going, I don't even know why these people buy a ticket. They look like they're bored, you know? So as a wrestler, you have to adapt and overcome a little bit and dig deep with your wrestling knowledge to be able to move the crowd. I'll give you just a brief example. I was wrestling Virgil. For the WWF, it was in Toronto, and it was usually a pretty hot crowd. They had just switched Virgil to babyface, and Virgil's a good guy. His wrestling knowledge, I didn't feel was in a pretty good position for the wrestling knowledge that he had as a wrestler. So I'm trying to lead him through a match, and not that he's, you know, just blind running drunk
ignorant or anything like that. I'm not saying that. He's a very, very intelligent guy. But what I'm saying is his experience level wasn't quite at that level yet. And so he's out there. He's wanting to do, you know, I want to do this and I want to do that. And I'm telling him, I says, I don't think you're going to get the reaction that you're looking for, but I'll be glad to do it. So we go out there, and sure enough, he wants to do this, that, and the other, and people are looking at him like he's, you know, got three eyeballs or something, you know. So finally I said, look, I said, let's settle this thing down, and let's get these people behind you. You know, they want to cheer you, not what necessarily that you do. And he didn't understand that. He thought just because he drops kick somebody that the people were going to automatically fall in love with him. You know, they don't fall in love with you for what you do. They fall in love for who you are as the character. And so I said, we've got to build your character. And so I'm going through the match of storytelling with him. And so finally I had to snatch him down and hold him in a reverse chin lock, almost in a three-quarter shoot, just to get him to settle down. And we're laying there on the mat, and I says, just rest a minute. Let the people show up. Let them cheer for you for a minute. And he's panicking because, I mean, it's dead silence. And so we're laying there. I mean, we're laying there, and, you know, you start hearing a few boring chants. You know, boring, boring. And I've got him in reverse chin lock, and I look at the crowd, and I said, if you want to see boring, I'll fall asleep in this hole. And so we just sat there for a minute. So finally then, and this place is sold out. This is at the Maple Leaf Garden. And so finally at the top of the building, you kind of start hearing people, Virgil, Virgil. And so finally, you know, the next thing you know, 2 or 3 minutes later, the whole arena's chanting it. I said, Virgil, we haven't done one move, and these people are cheering your name. How did that happen? Right? So he's trying to fight now to get out of the hole. He goes, we got to do something now. I said, no, we don't. We gotta make them want it even more. So he gives me a couple of elbows, and I poke him in the eye and pull him back down. Now we're building it. We're building it. We're building it. And so finally we get the people so hot that he goes, you know, he finally starts elbowing me in the stomach, goes, hits the ropes, gives me a tackle, another tackle. I'll leap over. He goes over, leap over again, you know, and then I go for a hip toss. He reverses it. Now drop kicks me. Now he's got me going up for a slam, up for another slam. Gives me another big drop kick. Then he goes to the top, you know. But he didn't understand. Get the people to like who you are as the character. And then yeah, he could have sit there and just stood in the ring and farted. And the people would have just, you know, been clapping, you know, uncontagiously because he didn't understand that part of it yet. But once he started to understand that a little bit, he got a little bit better. But as a wrestler, you have to know how to pull the strings in the match for your audience. All audiences are different. Some you don't have to do anything to, and the people are just super hot. Some that were like that, you've got to bring them down to a level, because once you get down so low, there's only one place to go, and that's up, right? So it was sometimes it was a struggle with some guys, but not all. But knowing what to do and when to do it helped more than sometimes knowing how to do it. You know, not knowing how to do a drop kick or how to do a hip toss, those things are important, but knowing when and timing and charisma, those things are very, very important. Sometimes outweigh the tickles and tackles that you can do.
Well, guys, we have our other with us, and I want to bring him on. I know he has a few questions as well. Randy Zellers, go right ahead.
All right. Hey, how you doing there, Mr. Riggins?
Man, I tell you what, if it got any better, it would be illegal.
Hey, shoot. Hey, I heard that mess. Man, shoot. with all that legalness and all this other stuff going on though, but all I gotta say is I've seen a lot of your matches when I was growing up. I just wanted to know, how was your time at Smoky Mountain for Mr. Cornette?
Oh, it was great. It was great.
Yep.
Got nothing to say. I got nothing but good to say about Jimmy. Jimmy called me and asked me, you know, told me kind of the role that I would be in there, and asked me if I wanted to do it. And, you know, I said, I'm thankful for the opportunity.
Because once again, this was at a time to where all the small territories had already kind of dried up, and you're not, you know, whenever you get booked, you're not just competing to get on the card and do well, but just think about all the other guys that he could call at the drop of a hat that would be there. So I was always honored when a promoter called me and said, "Hey, do you want to come and work for us?" You know, so I was always thankful for that. And also too, I owe a good friend of mine, Dutch Mantel. Dutch Mantel helped put my name out there for Jim Cornette to say, "Yeah, let's call Reno." So if it wouldn't been for Dutch Mantel, I may not even have gotten that call. So Dutch is always near and dear to my heart. Has always helped me out, whether if I was working in Memphis or working for Smoky Mountain, and he's always a great travel partner too. You could get in the car with Dutch and go, you know, 800 miles and feel like you just drove across town. He always kept you entertained, always with some great stories, and it was fun. And he's a guy that just doesn't talk wrestling when you're on the road driving. He can talk politics, he can talk movies, he can talk art, he can talk literature. I mean, he is a well-rounded gentleman, and I learned so much being in the car with him for the time that we were fortunate enough to travel together. So, but getting back to your original question, my time at Smoky Mountain, I wrestled some great guys there. Tracy Smothers, Jimmy Golden, Paul Orndorff, Tony Anthony, Ivan Koloff, just a few of the guys that come off to the top of my head. Who else?
Did you witness Chris Jericho and Lance Storm when they made their debut in the Smoky Mountain?
They came after I'd already was there for a while, and then I had left, and they came in after that.
Oh wow!
So I didn't get to cross paths with Jericho and Storm there, but I hear that they did an absolutely fabulous job when they was at Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and I started hearing the name Jericho, right along that time that when they were at Smoky Mountain Wrestling. So, So, my path with Chris Jericho crossed only once, and that was I did a benefit show for Brian Pillman. They did a thing in the Cincinnati area for Brian Pillman after he had passed away, and it was a heck of a card. My buddy Les Thatcher, I think, kind of helped organize the event. And Chris Jericho was there. Chris Benoit was there. Stone Cold Steve Austin was on the card. Myself, Stephen Dunn was on the card. Flash Flanagan was there. Nick Dinsmore, I think Rob Conway. And I've got a picture of it that I keep in my office. I think Terry Taylor was there. And you look at that picture, and there's a lot of young faces in that picture that were budding stars, and some guys, you know, went on to just to take over the world at that point. So it was a good time. That was the only time that my path and Chris Jericho, and matter of fact, we had got to have about a 10-15 minute conversation in the locker room that night. I went up and introduced myself and told him I'd been hearing his name and been hearing a lot of really good things about him, and that I wished him well, and I wished him a very successful career. And so see, if it wasn't for me wishing him, he'd never made it.
Yep. Hey, I heard that. Ooh-wee. And one of my other questions, actually, you just answered it, about going up and down the roads with, I mean, who was your favorite travel partner? And you said Dutch Mantel. And I've really enjoyed his work. As a wrestler and as a manager, oh man.
Yeah. You know, I always told Dutch, I said, why are you messing with this wrestling business? I said, you got to go out to Hollywood. You know, I could have seen him play a role like in the movie Tombstone. I mean, he was as a kid growing up. One of the things that drew me to be a fan of him, of Dutch Mantel, was his interviews. I felt like he gave a great interview. He had great content, great delivery, great timing, and doggone it, there's some guys that you see their interview work, and you go, oh,
yep.
My God, you know, that guy can do it. Jake the Snake, you know, another guy. I always admired his interview ability, you know, his promo
yes.
ability. You know, and I always try to distinguish the two. Some guys go out there and do a promo, you know.
Yep.
This Saturday night when I get you in the ring, I'm going to do this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. And then some guys do the interview where they tell the story. They lay the foundation, and they build upon that. And they verbally tell the story of why I'm pursuing this championship or why I'm pursuing revenge with you or reckoning with you. And so when you have guys that can do that and do it eloquently and charismatically, those guys are gold. In my opinion, those guys are gold. Those guys have talent. And then when you mix that with being able to get in the ring and perform at a tremendously high level, then that's the total package. There are some guys that had a $1 million body but couldn't put one foot in front of the other. And then you had some guys that could do all the flip-flops and flies in the world that you'd ever want to see, but you put a microphone in front of them, and they couldn't say their name. But when you had a guy that could talk the talk, get in the ring, and walk the walk, then you had something special. And that's you know, and then those guys are few and far between.
Yep, I agree with you on that one. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, how about, after a show, stuff like that, you and your buddies, what is like a favorite spot that you like to stop to get, like, grab something to eat, maybe grab a drink or something?
You know, I was always pretty quick to, and now if I'm, you know, I've got to drive 300 miles that night to get to the next town, I was more inclined to, you know, either drive all night and get there, get a hotel. I'd usually just go through the 7-Eleven or something like that and grab a snack and get in the car and go. But then, like, if we had time and we was going to, hey, the hotel's down the road and we're not going to leave until tomorrow or something, like, we got a flight tomorrow, then, you know, always the Waffle House. The reason I always say Waffle House, I could always get grilled chicken. I could get, you know, egg whites or whole eggs or whatever I wanted. And the other thing that I loved about Waffle House is that it was consistent, you know. Now, when I was in the Northeast, I always loved to go to the diners because I'd cheat on my diet, and they would have all the good stuff that you'd ever want, you know, pastrami sandwiches and all the good stuff that I shouldn't be eating on my diet, but I could eat at the diners there. And then down south, it was always Waffle House, just the consistency.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you can, I mean, you can every now and then have to make a waffle in or something.
yeah, Waffle House. That was one of my favorite spots too. When I visited O'Dixon.
Yeah.
Oh no, I mean the portions there. It's just a crime scene in itself.
Exactly.
Yep. And another question I have to ask you. Well, because since you went into depth of you and Brian Christopher and the chemistry, it was just nothing but great things about that match. And you guys were battling out over belts and all that. I mean, all the other stuff. I also saw a little glimpse of a video between you and Buddy Landell.
And was that Smoky Mountain?
Yeah, Smoky Mountain, yes.
Yeah. Oh, man. Buddy Landell, probably one of the most, is a guy that could have had probably one of the biggest runs in all of professional wrestling.
If he could have kept his, you know, personal life together. Always got along with Buddy. Buddy, you know, hey, Buddy, hey, Reno, we're working tonight. And we're, you know, I love it. Because I knew a guy like that I wasn't going to get hurt with. You know, sometimes when I go to do TV at WWF and they said, okay, hey, you're going to be working with this guy and this guy's new and this guy, that guy doesn't understand that he's got to take care of me. He just looks at it as that, okay, WWF's bringing in these guys as chopped meat, and if I kill one of them, so what? And so those guys, I didn't necessarily, and when I first started there, I had to do whatever I got. But after a while, when they realized I could wrestle a little bit, then I started getting, you know, better talent to work with. I got to start having matches like with Owen Hart. I started having matches with the Smoking Guns, Tatanka, Rick Martel, Tito Santana, you know, guys that, you know, wasn't going to hurt me, you know, because I want to go out and give them the best that I've got. But if I go out there and I work with a guy who's, you know, 6'8" and gas to the gills and can't put one foot in front of the other, and they have that guy, you know, drop me on my head from the top rope, then I can't go and make these other guys, you know.
Mm-mm.
So I was always appreciative kind of once I kind of got a little bit of my footing there that I was used better for those types of matches. I tell you, one of the best matches that I ever had at WWF, and this might be something that's on YouTube, I don't know, but my old partner, Stephen Dunn, and I was called up, I think, around in 98, and we worked with the Hardy Boys. And it was
Ooh.
One of their very first matches for television. So if you guys want to go find a little treasure there, Reno Riggins, Stephen Dunn versus the Hardy Boys for WWF,
okay.
WWE maybe it's time. Jimmy Cornette called us up and said, hey, they're looking for a team to work with the Hardy Boys. You guys want to come up, do TV? We said, yeah, appreciate the payday. So we went up there and worked with them, and we was hoping that that might be an opportunity for Jimmy to manage us, and we could have worked with those guys. But Vince McMahon didn't always necessarily care for tag team wrestling, and so that opportunity was cut short. And I don't know if necessarily Vince or what the deal was. I felt like we had a really good match, and I had worked with Matt and Jeff many times before, so I knew we could have a very creative match and very good matches with those guys, but it just never panned out for whatever reason. But I felt like that was an opportunity missed because at the time, you know, a lot of times when I was at WWF, you know, guys weren't my size. I'm you know, 5'11", and I was about 225. So at the time, if you weren't 6'5", you know, basically you pretty much wasn't getting much of a push. But I like the fact that they started going to what I consider more athletic guys, you know, your Eddie Guerreros and your Dean Malenkos and your,
yes.
and your Benoits and your Chris Jerichos. And I felt like that was missing so much from that company, more of an entertaining type of match, in my opinion. You know, I always consider professional wrestling like the circus. You know, some people want to come and see how big the elephants are. You know, people would come just to want to see how big Andre the Giant was. Some people
mm-hmm.
want to come and see the people on the flying trapeze. Well, they want to see the guys jumping off the top rope. Or they want
yep.
to see the guys do all the tickle tackles and tricks like that to see the monkeys. Or, you know, then they want to see the bushwhackers. They want to see the clowns. You know, so I always compare professional wrestling to the circus. There's a lot of parallels there. And as a promoter, you've got to present many different forms of entertainment to find that draw that is in each and every one of the wrestling fans. Every wrestling fan doesn't have the same taste. And where I think a lot of promoters in the past have kind of missed that boat, you've got to sprinkle in an array of different talent and make it work so that more fans, you know, you appeal to something there. And I see a lot of women, you know, beautiful women wrestling
yep.
On television now. When back then, not to slight the women that wrestled back then, there just wasn't enough of them. And because, I mean, women back then, they didn't want to get in wrestling. And then the ones, you know, some that you did see, they weren't, beauty queens, you know, and not to slight them. And some were very beautiful, you know, some were very beautiful. But nowadays it's almost kind of like you've got to win a bikini contest in order for to get to the next step of trying to be a lady wrestler. So,
that's just
my two cents. Or Barbie,
I
mean, everybody, I mean, it's a God-given fact. Everybody likes to look at beautiful things, whether it's a flower, whether it's a butterfly, whether it's a woman. You know, there's a lot of women that watch wrestling because where else can they go and see guys in underwear, you know, all jacked up and in shape, you know, jumping around. So, you know, there's something for everybody.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And my last question to you is, like you know, like you've been around a whole bunch of locker rooms and everything. Was there like a particular wrestler that you had to call out? You don't have to say any names, but did you have to call them out because of their hygiene, like their gear wasn't up to par, or just all together, or like all together in your
I never had to hey man, you need to wash that, or you need to leave it at the next town, or you need to burn it. I never had to do any of that type of stuff, you know.
Were you around anyone?
I'm sure probably at some independent card somewhere, you know. I'm sure, I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. But generally, when you get to the WWE level, back for me, WWF back then, or WCW, generally you have guys that have been around the block more than once. And those, if those were an issue for somebody, they got corrected long before they got to that point, because if they didn't, they would still never made it to that point. Now, you got to, like, and I've heard stories like Andre, he would do stuff on purpose, but he's doing it as a rib. He's not doing it because he doesn't know any better. I never ran across anybody like that.
All righty. Hey, well, thank you. Well, I have to say thank you for your time of talking with us here on Turnbuckle Turmoil. I'm going to go ahead here and pass it on over to the sign guy.
All right. Thank you, guys. Well, Mr. Riggins, we are out of time here on the show today. It has been a pleasure to have you on here. Hopefully we'll get the chance to do it again sometime. And I want to give you time if there's anything you want to say to the listeners, if you want to plug and promote anything, any appearances or merchandise, social medias, whatever you'd like, floor is yours.
Well, hey, I just wanted to thank you guys for having me and remembering me. I don't get it as recognized out in public anymore like I used to years ago. And I appreciate you shedding some light on the guys that were in my position with big major companies at that time. And I guess the message I'd want to send everybody who's listening in your audience is, try to not be as judgmental to your fellow neighbor, and try to love everybody. Life is too short. I'd rather be happy than sad. And try to make every day the best day of your life.
Like I said, it's been a pleasure having you on. We appreciate your time greatly. Fans, definitely get on YouTube. And if you've not seen Reno Riggins, I don't know why you wouldn't have. He was in every major promotion you can think of during his career. So look him up, research it. I think you'll really enjoy his work, and we will be back with you next week. Next Friday afternoon, we have the NWA's Robert King, and 1 week from today, we'll be joined by the Boogie Woogie Boy, Gary Valiant. So everyone stay safe out there, and we will talk to you soon.